practices, techniques, strategies, and also hear from speakers to better help us all preserve our neighborhoods. It is with great pleasure that I welcome Mr. Sam Kinski. Mr. Kinski is President of the BBC. He's got his pants going on, and please give him a welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here this morning on a beautiful Monday morning. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what PDC does and how it relates to the issue of preservation. As you may know, PDC is charged with economic development, with creating jobs, creating new tax revenue, and enhancing neighborhoods. And in a city like ours, a dense city, that's a largely built city, development usually implies the loss of something. So you may think that given that future orientation that we generally are unsympathetic to the concept of preservation. In fact, I think our position on the concept of preservation and how we deal with historic structures and how we deal with the historic fabric of the city is a much more nuanced position and requires us to strike a balance, which at times is a difficult balance to strike, but I think that we do as good a job as we can with that. And what I wanted to do is take you through kind of a spectrum of responses to preservation that EDC has struck over the course of the last several years based on different conditions that it encountered. So we can start, I think, with the first end of the spectrum. The first end of the spectrum is a neighborhood like Willets Point, which is, in fact, a built-out environment. And there are, in fact, uses, historic uses, one could say, on the site. Our response to Willets Point is one that's more evocative of classic redevelopment, something that's akin to what the city had done in the 50s or 60s, coming in and dramatically changing the neighborhood. Willets Point is about a 62-acre site. It actually has been referenced in historical works like The Great Gatsby. It was the site of a coal ash dump. There are references in The Great Gatsby to driving out to Long Island and passing the glowing embers of the coal ash heap. As a result of that, it's a very toxic site, and the site has been leaching petroleum byproducts into the Flushing River now for decades, and as far back as Robert Moses, people have been seeking to redevelop Willets Point. Our approach here is not a preservation approach, which may not surprise you. We have a plan which will transform this 62-acre site into a new mixed-use community. In order to do that, because of the site conditions, because of the fact that it lies in a marsh, in a floodplain, what we have to do is literally remove all of the current uses from the site. We have to demolish them. We have to clean all of the land of all of the toxins. And then we have to actually raise the land by about 5 feet to take it out of the floodplain. And then it can be developed on top of that. So this is an example of one end of the development spectrum. I think what's more common for us is something that's less extreme than this. And so what I'll take you to next is in the category of what I call adaptive reuse. So here what you have is historic structures, historic environments where there's a historic building of some sort that I think people generally believe is worth preserving, but the use for which it was constructed is no longer applicable. And so what we at EDC try to do is to figure out how can you adapt that building in some ways. You may have to modernize it, you may have to make some alterations, but largely adapt it in order to bring it to a new use for the 21st century. So the first example of this is the High Line. And the High Line was constructed because in the 1840s, a train line was run down the west side in order to bring provisions into the then growing city and to provide an outlet for cargo that was coming into the port on the west side. Over time, that train line became a very busy train line, and I think it was 10th Avenue was known as the Avenue of Death because so many train accidents occurred there. They actually hired at one point men on horseback to ride with flags to warn about the coming of trains. So in the 1920s, it was decided that this condition was no longer acceptable in a modern city, and so the High Line project was undertaken. And it was a project that was about $150 million, which in today's dollars would be about $2 billion. And they built an elevated structure that actually went down the middle of the block, so not to blight the west side in the way that the elevated trains did elsewhere in the city. It ran through existing buildings in order to allow efficient delivery to those buildings, and was used extensively. In the 1950s, with the rise of truck-based transportation, use of the High Line began to decline. Pieces of the High Line were taken out of service in the 1960s, and finally, in 1980, the last train ran down the High Line. So the question was, what do you do with the High Line? It's an elevated structure. There were actually landowners who owned the land underneath the High Line who thought that they had valuable development rights that they wanted to get access to. It was thought for some time of tearing down the High Line, but instead the decision was made to adapt the High Line to a new use. And so the Bloomberg administration, working with a group called Friends of the High Line, issued started a competitive process for the redesign of the High Line. There was a new zoning amendment that was passed, which allowed owners of the land to essentially move the air rights that they had from the High Line to the side of those avenues away from the middle of the block. And now it's being developed for as a park. And the first phase of this park, which runs from Gansevoort to, I think, 20th Street, is set to open in June. It's going to be a great asset to the community. It's served the purpose of economic development as well, because you're seeing a massive development of especially vacant lots and underused lots on the avenues, of very innovative architecture, which is turning this into an extremely interesting neighborhood. And you've managed to preserve the High Line. So that's one example of adaptive reuse. Another example is one that I know has engendered some controversy, but it's the Battery Maritime Building. The Battery Maritime Building was completed in 1909, and it was the Manhattan end of a commuter ferry line. It was one of 17 commuter ferry lines that served Manhattan at the time of its construction. It was meant to provide a foil architecturally to the Whitehall ferry terminal of the Staten Island Ferry, and it joined with the then existing transportation system. The 3rd and 9th Avenue elevated trains ended down here, and commuters were able to come there and then disperse throughout the city. This building, unfortunately, in 1937, fell into disuse when the ferry service that it was meant to serve was terminated. And so eventually the city invested about $60 million in reconstructing this building. We actually had to remove the 11,000 pieces of the facade, almost like a jigsaw puzzle, in order to restore the building. We reapplied them. We painted it the original colors that had been repainted over the years. We restored the interior spaces. And what we are now doing is we're seeking a ULURP approval, the city's land use review process approval, in order to turn this facility into a combination of public space, ferry terminal again, especially serving Governor's Island, and also a hotel, which will be developed by the Dermot Company. They're seeking to invest about $150 million. There would be a four-story addition on top, which I think is really the only controversial part of this project, although it is a controversial part of the project. But in order to make this economically viable for them, in order to allow them to reactivate some of the existing interior spaces, there's the demolition of a corrugated metal exterior on the top floor, which was added after the building had been constructed. That will be demolished. A four-story structure will be put on top, and that will be a boutique hotel. So again, another example of taking an existing historic building, not demolishing the building like we're looking at doing in Willis Point, but preserving the building, but having it serve a new purpose because the original purpose for which it was constructed no longer applies. Another example of this is the Kingsbridge Armory, which when it was constructed in time for World War I, 1917, was the largest armory in the world. And some say that it still has the largest drill hall. I don't know if that's true or not. But this was built for the 8th Regiment Armory and has dominated the skyline of Kingsbridge in the Bronx for a number of generations. Again, this is a building that outlived its useful purpose. The military decided that they no longer needed it, and it came to the city. And what we found when we took possession of this building was a roof that had largely fallen apart. There were pigeons inside. It would rain. When it rained outside, it rained inside this building. So the city put a significant amount of money into renovating the building. You can see here what it looked like. We put a significant amount of money into renovating this building, and then we issued a request for proposals based on community input. There was a desire for retail uses, for also for community space. And so we're now moving forward through the city's land use review process with the related companies. And what the plans the related companies have here is to basically create a building within a building. One of the reasons why they were selected over some of the other respondents was that their plan for the Kingsbridge Armory actually allowed you to see the existing structure of the building, because they're going to be building a new building inside of this building that will have a significant retail component to it, will have a significant amount of community space, and it's going to create thousands, about 1,700, I think, construction jobs, about 2,000 permanent jobs, which are of vital importance to a community like this. Taking a facility that today generates no economic activity for the neighborhood, and though a beautiful building, is essentially an eyesore of light in the middle of the community, and turning it into an active space, generating economic activity. And do we have pictures of what? No, so you'll have to imagine what the it's going to look like. But this is going through the land use review process. And then the last building is, I'm not sure if that's
the post office.
Yes. That's not the post office. But the Moynihan post office was built to replace the main post office that was down on Park Row in Lower Manhattan, and it was designed with the largest, I think it's the largest Corinthian colonnade in the world at the time. The famous quote over that colonnade, which I learned last night, actually comes from Herodotus and describes the Persian couriers of Xerxes the First. But this is the building. So, and the building was meant to complement Penn Station. Now, as we know, Penn Station is one of the great tragedies of redevelopment that the city and perhaps the world has ever known. And so now that which it was meant to act as the foil to is no longer there. Senator Moynihan had the brilliant idea of turning this into a train station. The plan for this facility is to take the front half of the building. It's really two buildings. There's the original building that was built, I think, in 1914 or so, and then there was an addition that was built later. It's to take this front portion of it. It's in the shape of a donut, to hollow out the donut and create an atrium in the middle of the building, and then to have this serve as an entrance to the trains that go below, because since the trains run from west to east under the from the Hudson, most of them pass under the Farley Building, with many of the platforms extending to it. It's actually an extremely complicated project, much more complicated than at least I at first thought when I started working on this, because, for example, not all the platforms reach to there, so you have to extend the platforms. When you extend the platforms, you have to actually change the track layout, because some of the tracks actually narrow before they get to here, and so you have to extend that narrowing. There's also a concourse that runs under 8th Avenue that currently only allows you to access tracks about halfway down the series of tracks, and we're seeking to expand that so that commuters from all the tracks would be able to get up and out through the station. The problem with that is you also have the 8th Avenue subway that goes here. So in order to extend that concourse, you have to spaghetti around the 8th Avenue subway, which is another engineering nightmare. I wish I could tell you that this project is on track and is going to happen any day now. We have a peripheral involvement in this project. It's largely run by the state through the Empire State Development Corporation. We're in conversations with them. We're in conversations with the Port Authority about figuring out how to get this funded. The city had committed to put about $150 million, but the price of this project, like so many other infrastructure projects, keeps escalating. Everyone knows the state of the economy and the budget. But this is something that we remain committed to. We think that this would be a great opportunity for the city. The post office has largely moved out of this facility. They still operate the front of the house post office operations here, but they've consolidated most of their back of the house operations into the Morgan facility, which is a few blocks to the west and south. So it's this beautiful building that's largely unused. The state has already spent almost $250 million acquiring the building, so it would also be a good return on their investment if we actually did something with it. So this is another example of what hopefully will be adaptive reuse. We hope it will be a station for Amtrak in particular so that we can free up space at Penn Station and maybe start to clean that facility up as well. What you don't realize, in addition to the fact that it Penn Station on the east side is an ugly building, it's underground, it's dark. Part of the reason why there are as many narrow hallways there is as there are is because the railroads actually have their offices underground. And so a lot of the space that could be at least open underground concourses is instead occupied by back of the house operations for the railroad. So that's another thing which we could allow them to expand here. Might be able to at least improve the conditions of Penn Station until one day, hopefully, the economy will recover and we can do something much more dramatic with Penn Station. So that then takes us to the next end of the spectrum, which we started at redevelopment, we moved to adaptive reuse, and then the question is, well, what do you do with a historic structure where the use actually continues to make sense? How do you actually modernize that facility? And for preservationists, this is probably the end of the spectrum that I would imagine you would be most sympathetic to, because you're actually using the buildings that were constructed for their intended purpose. And so Bush Terminal is a great example of where we're trying to do this. And this, of all the projects that I'm going to go into, is probably farthest away, is probably closest to the middle of the spectrum of the projects, because it's a little bit of a hybrid. But Bush Terminal was started in 1909 by someone named Irving Bush, who inherited this property from his father, who had a refinery on the site that was swept into Standard Oil Company. And what he decided to do at the turn of the century, as the Brooklyn waterfront was developing, was to develop essentially a maritime city within a city. And so he constructed a series of warehouses here, a series of docks, and he actually had his own railroad system, he had his own power system, and there were thousands of people working here at its height. Now, over time, as the Brooklyn waterfront began to decline, as shipments, the way that people brought shipments into the port changed, and we went from break bulk cargo to containerized cargo, a lot of the business that had been along the Brooklyn waterfront migrated out of the city, and so this area fell into disrepair. Since taking this project over, the city, EDC, which only really got control of it in the 1990s, has been trying to figure out, well, how do you take this area and turn it into something that once again serves its original purpose, that creates maritime jobs, that creates industrial jobs. And so we've been working on a major infrastructure improvement plan. You can see here the state of the facility. You have the piers literally falling into the harbor. You have multi-story industrial buildings, which no longer really serve the purposes of industrial users today. People like to have large floor areas spread over a single floor, maybe two floors, which makes the upper floors very difficult for for us to rent. There are also issues with fire codes. A lot of these buildings were built long before modern fire codes were put in place. We have stairways, for example, that are literally like climbing ladders, which the fire department would never allow today. So what we're doing is we are, first of all, investing tens of millions of dollars into the infrastructure of the area. We're improving the electrical connection, the roadways, to make these buildings such that modern users can access them. We're also going to, in a few cases, likely have to demolish some of the buildings because they literally are beyond repair. But for the most part, what we're looking to do is to renovate these buildings, bring them up to code, tenant them with new small industrial users, and also trying to reactivate the waterfront. We're actually turning this pier area into a new park, which is going to have passive recreation, and eventually when we have the money for it, active recreation as well. There's a one of the piers, Pier 6, which we're looking to reactivate and bring back great bulk cargo shipping. We've had a lot of success with that a few blocks north of here at the South Brooklyn Marine Terminal. It turns out that a lot of the great bulk shipping, which moved to New Jersey, really wants to be on the east side of the harbor because what happens is the customers are here in the city, and so people have to ship the stuff in to New Jersey and then put them on trucks, which is very inefficient and as polls keep going up, very expensive. So, we hope that the future of this is a brighter one, and what in particular we want to see Bush Terminal return to what it once was, which is a major center for maritime uses and industrial uses. Another example, and this is probably a better example of preserving an existing building for its intended use, although in this case slightly different than its intended use, the Brooklyn Army Terminal. Brooklyn Army Terminal was built when the United States entered World War I. And the federal government realized that it needed centralized facilities to gather weaponry and troops and to ship them over to Europe for the fight. This building, which is 5 million square feet on 95 acres, was designed in 3 months by Cass Gilbert, who designed the Woolworth Building and the Customs House. It was then actually constructed in 17 months. Unfortunately, it was finished after the end of World War I, which I guess is a good thing because it means World War I was relatively short for the United States. But in World War II, this became the primary center for supplying the troops. There were over 3 million American troops who passed through the Brooklyn Army Terminal on their way to war, and I think I read somewhere that 85% of the war material that went out for the fights in both the Pacific and the Atlantic passed through the Brooklyn Army Terminal. It was literally a factory of a building. Locomotives would pull up to the building for giant gantry cranes, which would lift the weaponry off of the trains. There were receiving sites going up several stories where the weapons would be stored, and then there were giant elevators that actually could carry tanks that would move the material until it was shipped out by boat to go across the Atlantic or the Pacific. There were something like 50,000 people who worked here at the height of the war effort. Again, fortunately, World War II eventually ended. The Brooklyn Army Terminal then over time fell into disrepair, and the city took the site over in the 1980s. What we've been doing since the 1980s is taking the former war distribution center and turning it into a center for small business, light manufacturing, and actually we're now working towards also bringing biotechnology into this area. Here you can see a picture of it. Giant buildings and then the pier facilities as well. There are about 70 building companies that are located here. It's actually reached 100% occupancy at one time last year with the economy that's down probably into the low 90s. But it's still a very vital center. We're working with SUNY Downstate Medical Center in the state to put in a biotech facility as well. We have our first biotech tenant in the building, which is a group called IAVI, which is one of the leading entities in the world that's seeking a vaccine against the AIDS virus. And what's great about this, and what I think is, should be heartening for all of us about this, is that all this was done under the full supervision of SHPO, the State's Historic Preservation Organization. The colors, for example, on the exterior restoration have all been endorsed by SHPO. In the interior of this building here, there's a huge atrium. We were actually asked by them not to paint the walls at all because they didn't want us to cover the soot that had been left by all of the locomotives. So we did that. So it's been a very sensitive treatment, I think, of this, but has also created thousands of jobs. And hopefully will generate new industries and new tax revenue for the city. So I think this is a very successful example of taking a historic building, updating it, using it for its original purpose, but not losing its historic nature. Which brings us to the last project that I wanted to talk to you about today, which is Coney Island. And Coney Island is an interesting project because there are a number of very historic structures, and I think there's a general consensus that the historic use is one that should be preserved. Among the historic structures you can see here, the parachute jump, the cyclone, the wonder wheel, and what we're seeking to do is to figure out a way to, first of all, link these structures, which over the years have become more and more separate from one another as parts of Coney Island have fallen into disrepair. You can see here the parachute jump is isolated by this parking lot that's filled with buses. The Wonder Wheel, which looks more integrated here, I think when this summer begins, is going to feel a lot more isolated because the Astroland Park, which had connected it with the cyclone, has now been shut down. So what we're trying to do is figure out a way to link these historic structures, to bring back historic use, which has largely disappeared. In the last several years, the amusement district has shrunk from around 9 acres of a few years ago to 3 acres and maybe less this summer. And we think that it's essential for the future of Coney Island to get this rezoning put in place. What we're looking to do is to create a park which the city would own, which is about a 9-acre park along the boardwalk, which would be part of a 27-acre amusement district. As you can see, it would put a new road in, which would link the cyclone with the parachute jump and the Wonder Wheel. We recently reached an agreement with the former owner of the Astroland Amusement Park, who saved the Astroland Rocket, which is one of the historic icons. Coney Island here is in storage right now in Staten Island, but we hope to have it back in place when we open the new amusement park. We also acquired the B&B Carousel, which is the last of historic carousels from Old Coney Island. We're in the process of restoring that in Ohio, which I guess is the place where you restore historic carousels. That should be back in place in a new public plaza that we're calling Steeple Chase Plaza, which will be very close to the parachute jump. And that will be open to the public as well. And this is an example where you don't really have you have a few historic remnants of past use. You don't have a lot of historic structures, but you have an historic use and I think a collective memory of that historic use. And what we're working very hard to do is to bring that back in a way that not only will preserve what was once there, but will also enhance what is there and will create new memories for a new generation of people in a way that's economically feasible, also most importantly. And we think that this project is going to create many, many thousands of construction jobs, 17,000 construction jobs, and 6,000 permanent jobs when it's completed. So that's kind of the spectrum of our treatment of historic structures and historic uses. I think, as I mentioned at the beginning, in some cases in a city like New York, when you redevelop an area, you really have to start from scratch. And there aren't a lot of places where you can start from scratch without eliminating something that's there. And so in a place like Willets Point, we try to be sympathetic to what is there. We've tried very hard move businesses that have been located in Willets Point to new locations. We've had a lot of success with that. But we believe that you really need to wipe the slate clean there in order to remediate it, to make it physically safe for the people of the city in order to redevelop it. In the middle of the spectrum, you have adaptive reuse, where you take historic buildings, you restore those historic buildings, but you put them to new uses that are business generators and job generators, but also sympathetic to the physical structures. And then on the other end of the spectrum, there's taking historic structures, restoring them, and continuing to apply them to their new uses, but in ways that are economically feasible in the 21st century. It's not an easy balance for us to strike, and if we had unlimited resources, maybe we would do some of these projects differently, but I think for the most part, given the resources that we have, given the constraints within which we work, that we've been successful in our preservation efforts, and that the city will be a better place for a lot of these projects. So I'm happy to take any questions that you might have.
Regarding Coney Island, we changed pictures. The rendering on the lower right, apartments in the background, and I'm aware that there are some apartment complexes being proposed or were being proposed for that area. And I didn't know how that was going to be incorporated into this.
Well, probably don't have the right slide here to show this, but we basically divide Coney Island into three regions. This kind of shows up. This is East Van Park here. So we have Coney West, Coney East, and Coney North. Coney East is the 27-acre amusement district. And it will include the 9-acre park and also what we call entertainment retail, indoor entertainment, and hotels as well to activate that area. There will not be any apartments in this part of the project because we don't believe that apartments and an amusement district are compatible. What we've seen in other areas is that over time the residents of the apartments complain about the noise and the crowds and you lose, and the residents vote and the amusements don't. And, here though, we are looking to build housing, which is very important for this area. This is one of the poorest neighborhoods in the city. It has an unemployment rate that's about twice the city average. 60% of the residents of Coney Island live in NYCHA housing, in public housing. And we're looking to build about 4,500 units of new housing with 20% affordability. Most of that will be built on vacant land, so it's almost all incremental, unlike some other projects where you're replacing existing housing to build the new housing. Here, almost all of this will be brand new. It will also create about 500,000 square feet of retail to service the community. This community is incredibly underserved by retail. Has the second largest, longest commute that's two times the city average for people who do go to work here. We hope through the retail and the amusement district to create these thousands of jobs, which presumably people in the neighborhood will be able to take advantage of. So the answer to your question is the apartments are here and here, not here.
And Marty Mark wants to make this commission work 12 months, not just the summer.
Well, so do we.
Okay.
the issue that you face with urban amusement parks of this size are that if you look across the country, they're all struggling. And the reason why they're struggling is because almost all of them are outdoor amusement parks, and they operate 3 or maybe 4 months out of the year. And so the crowds aren't sufficient to generate the revenues, which allow the parks then to invest in the rides, and the rides are what really attract people. So what we found in our research is that successful parks have a combination of outdoor amusements and indoor amusements as well. They also have other uses that subsidize the amusements, which is why we're proposing the hotels as well. And then this model has worked, and we think it can work here. We also think the proximity of Coney Island to JFK makes it a place where you could attract people coming off of planes, either spend some time here on a layover or spend time here on your way out of the city. So we definitely want this to be a 12-month amusement area. And in fact, we think if it's not a 12-month amusement area, it's likely not going to work.
And is the aquarium an important part of that 12-month?
Yes, absolutely. There's money separate from this project in the budget for capital improvements to the aquarium. The aquarium is part of the Wildlife Society, and they're having their own budget issues. So they, I believe, also feel that the facility needs to be updated. I don't think that they're yet at a point where they have a financially feasible plan for doing that. We have some city money there. There was at least at one point some state money. I'm not sure if that's still there. But that will be part of the long-term plan. And surely the one thing that we do know would be extremely helpful to the aquarium is to increase traffic. And that's something that we feel very confident that our plan will do. It will both increase traffic and also increase the number of people living in the area to go to the aquarium.
Talking about increased traffic, most of the projects you've discussed are on the periphery of New York, where there is space and there's an ability to handle increased traffic. Does the Development Corporation handle changes within more congested areas where increasing traffic flow by changing the use of a building or an area will be a problem?
We do absolutely have projects that are both in the middle of the city and on the periphery. The one thing I'd point out about almost all these projects is that they're extremely well served by multiple transportation modes. Coney Island, for example, has one of the busiest subway stations in the system. That four or five different lines come to. Willets Point is served by both the Long Island Railroad and the subway. You have train access as well as access right to the Gowanus Expressway and access to the water and Bush Terminal and the Brooklyn Army Terminal. What our goal is to create transit-oriented development. You see that, for example, at a project that we're doing in Long Island City, Queens Plaza Garage. We've taken a garage that sat largely unused, we're demolishing that, we're creating a new central business district for the city there. The first phase of that is under construction, extremely well served by subways. We're also working in Lower Manhattan on the redevelopment of the World Trade Center, another very well served facility by public transportation. Now, with respect to your specific question about what do you do to mitigate traffic concerns, a few things. One is that any major project that we undertake has to be accompanied by an environmental impact statement. That environmental impact statement has to look very carefully at the traffic impacts of the project, and it has to include mitigation for any additional traffic that's created. So, you know, it's difficult to say as a general matter what our approach to traffic is, but on each project we have a response to the traffic issue. The other thing that we're doing more broadly is, as I mentioned, focusing on areas that are well served by public transportation, where we feel that the people who use these facilities will be attracted to use public transportation rather than create a large amount of additional car traffic, which we think is the big problem that the city faces. We also have introduced in the past plans to lower car traffic throughout the city, things like congestion pricing. From our perspective, unfortunately, that didn't pass in the state legislature, but we're focused on making New York a greener and more sustainable city. So that's a priority for us. It's reflected in every project we do. It's reflected in the areas that we're focused on, and we're always seeking ways to take cars off of the city's roads.
This is Nicola Tula from Resources. On Staten Island, when you get off the boat and into National Icon, there's a Kill Dan Cull waterfront, and there are historic waterfront communities all along this waterfront, and Snug Harbor is in the middle. This would be the Greenway Trail. It's already done about a mile of it, but this would continue to the sacred sites of West Brighton, where this 2100 BC Jack Dial was founded. So the Greenway Trail is funded by the federal government in large part, 70%, and it would simply take doing it. Milling would be, you know, they throw out milling. And, you know, signage is a heritage trail. This would open up the whole world. This should be Hamptons, and be, you know, a Mother's Vineyard, a Greenwich Village, next to New York, you know, next to the greatest city in the world. And, you know, it's an incredible resource, and everything would happen from that. And it's also affordable housing, because it's cheaper to have, you know, even a modest house fitted, you know, And it would be extraordinary, yet, you know, nothing happens. Says it happens. EDC, of course, owns the right-of-way. And additionally, some of the right-of-way, you know, it all has to be rebuilt.
Just the railroad right-of-way that you're talking about?
Yeah. Yeah. And, of course, we need something and that would be, it has to be redone at some point. When it's redone, it's so simple to do a trail. People could walk with the ships before, or walk, you know, home, or go out the ferry to go over, you know. So it really is an unknown. It's like the great big gorilla. I mean, it's an incredible resource. And, you know, hopefully it'll be done now. In fact, tomorrow it goes. Land use study at Southern Harbor. So hopefully we will get it done.
Well, what we're doing in Staten Island right now on the west shore and the north shore, because we're undertaking, I'm assuming this is what the meeting that you're going to is, we're undertaking a major study with a number of different city agencies, including the Department of City Planning, what the future of both of those areas will be. The problem that I think a lot of people recognize has occurred in Staten Island is that after the Verrazano Bridge was constructed, that there never really was a master plan for Staten Island. That planning has happened in something of a helter-skelter way. And so what we want to do is we want to put a vision on the table, a master plan on the table for what are really the last frontiers of Staten Island, the west shore and the north shore. The transit right-of-way is a major part of the west shore, the north shore study. It goes through a number of industrial areas, residential areas, and then underused areas which formerly were industrial and now are lying mostly fallow. And we hope to have the results of that study back in September or October. And I think the goal there is, again, consistent with what I was saying a minute ago, create transit-oriented development, to create jobs, and to create new housing for the city, but to do it in a way that's environmentally friendly and sustainable. I don't know specifically about the Greenway issue that you're raising, and what I can do is I can give you my card and I can put you in touch with the people who are doing the study to make sure that they are aware of it. I'm sure they are, but I think it's important that you speak to them directly so that they know. So why don't we talk afterwards?
Given that all that Sunset Park stuff on the waterfront, given that you've said here and your waterfront people have said in many meetings in the network that a lot of companies do want to move their waterfront activities to their shipping activities to New Jersey, to Portland and other places on this side of the water, why is only a small percentage of the Sunset Park stuff currently being planned?
Well, it's actually a large percentage of it. The land that we control is the South Brooklyn Marine Terminal, Bush Terminal, and the Brooklyn Army Terminal. At Brooklyn Army Terminal, I mentioned what we're doing there. The major pier facility at the Brooklyn Army Terminal has been rehabilitated by EDC, is now serving regularly as a ferry landing. For ferry service, which just started from the Rockaways and stops at Sunset Park on its way to Manhattan. Bush Terminal, I described what we were doing. The South Brooklyn Marine Terminal, we've actually had an enormous amount of success. There's a couple of new cement processing facilities that have either been built or are under construction there, which will allow us to ship construction materials by water instead of by trucks, which takes many, many trucks off the city's roads. We're also working on a new break bulk shipping facility with a company called Axis. This is a city-owned facility. Axis is making, I think, about a $10 million investment in the city-owned facility. We're putting in another $30 million, which will allow a number of different break bulk cargo items to come in. That work has actually begun on that. We're working with a company called Sims Hugo New. Put in a major recycling facility there. We intend to start dredging, which is the first step towards construction on that project in the next couple of months. Sometime before the end of the summer, we will be started there. Then when you move up to Red Hook in Atlantic Basin, one of the reasons why we haven't been able to reactivate that up until now is because we actually leased that space from the Port Authority. And as some of you may know, there had been an intention at one point to convert the Red Hook waterfront into more residential and recreational uses. When it was decided in about 5 or 6 years ago to keep the container terminal in the northern portion of the Red Hook waterfront, we started to rethink Atlantic Basin. We're almost done negotiating a lease extension with the Port Authority at Atlantic Basin, which is allowing us to bring a company called Phoenix Beverages to Pier 11, which is located there, which is going to be a major carbon reducer of the project, because what Phoenix Beverages does right now is they're a beer importer. They bring their beer into New Jersey, put it on trucks, ship it into Long Island City, then put it on trucks again and ship it around the city. What we're going to do is we're going to now ship from New Jersey to Brooklyn, or bring in directly to Brooklyn the imported beer, and then distribute from there, which will mean that you don't have all these huge tractor trailers coming into the city from New Jersey. And it may not sound like it's a big deal, but it's thousands and thousands of truck trips every year that we're going to be able to take off the city's road. I'm trying to remember the statistic. I think it's something like 15,000 or whatever it is. It's thousands of truck trips that you're eliminating. We also have the Brooklyn Cruise Terminal, which is on Pier 12, which with our extension we can make more investments in. And we're working very hard to increase the cruise traffic there, but that's also been another maritime success. So there's a lot of activity there. I think Bush Terminal is the hole in the donut. We only took control of that relatively recently. As I said, a lot of the buildings are in really bad shape, so we're working on a master plan for that. We hope to have movement on that as well. But there is maritime use all along the Brooklyn waterfront, and I think it may not look like it because there's a lot of work going on, but I think when you go there in another 5 or 6 years, it will be a very different place from what it is now, and it's sat dormant for way too long.
Do you have a rough percentage idea of, like, 10 years from now, what EDCs, like Sunset Park waterfront, would be, what percentage of that would be shipping related?
Well, I would group it in shipping, manufacturing, and distribution. You know, I think, oh, and one other thing I didn't ask, sorry, we're looking also to reactivate the rail facilities on the Sunset Park waterfront. I would say the vast majority, I can't think of what the percentage is, but I would say the vast majority will be that, and the biggest piece that won't be shipping, manufacturing, or distribution will be our biotech facility at that, which I think is also serving an important purpose.
I noticed recently in CityLand that the Foreign Exchange Building, I don't know if this gets back, it's the default of the long-term owner. And it becomes, it's sort of a poster child for city-owned endangered buildings. I wonder what plans there are for that, if any. I also wonder the other one, of course, is the Bronx Courthouse, not the Courthouse. And also, is Pier A, EDC, or is that a state? Yeah, it just, what, how do you envision dealing with some of these enormously difficult buildings? And also, is EDC subject to binding language for people who move on?
I believe we are. I know we always do.
You are sure.
Almost positive by law. Foreign exchange building is actually not as simple. Well, it's not, the ownership situation is not that simple. It's actually, we've sought to get the building back from the long-term tenant that we signed up, who has let this building fall into terrible neglect. It's actually, at this point, I think, a danger to the community. She declared bankruptcy. As a result of that, the transfer of title has been stayed by the bankruptcy court. So the city actually doesn't control the site. We're in court trying to get possession of it, and once we do get possession, then we'll be able to hopefully stabilize the building. But at the moment, we can't touch the building. So there's nothing that we're doing, we EDC are doing there now. The Bronx Borough Courthouse, which...
It's the very, very loud one at
the
intersection. Yeah, the hub.
Yeah.
which was to go to a charter school, which is fine, except not that we helped us a charter school and not raise money.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know that that's in EDC's portfolio. I need to check on that. I know the building, exactly the building that you're talking about, but I don't believe that's in our portfolio. Tier A is in our portfolio, and this, I think, is one of the great success stories, although if you walk by, you wouldn't know this, but we designated in 1987 or 1988 a developer to redevelop that. And it was frozen in the developer's hands. The one developer changed into another developer, and it was frozen for 20-something years. Last year, we finally reached an agreement with the developer. We took the developer out, and then we reached an agreement with Battery Park City Authority. And so we've signed a lease with Battery Park City Authority. Battery Park City Authority is now in agreement that they will rehabilitate the pier. They have a great track record in Lower Manhattan. There's $30 million in the budget for the rehabilitation. They're going to be starting underwater work very shortly. And then once they finish that, they're going to move to the structure itself. They're still working on, and they're going to be responsible for doing this, they're still working on programming the building. One possibility is the National Park Service ferries to Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island, which I think would be a great use. The National Park Service has said that they may have other ideas, but even if not that, just as we were trying to get this out of the hands of the developers, we did a little bit of research on our own. There are a lot of users who would be interested in this facility. I'm confident is going to be in a much better place very soon.
In the Manhattan Bill neighborhood, I have to do with Columbia, but I think it's familiar with what Columbia does in communities. Whether one is planning to do up there now is benign or not, what is the possibility that so-called eminent domain will come in to help these private developers as well?
I know that, first of all, that project, not selling bureaucrats, but it's a state project, it's not a city project. So the Empire State Development Corporation has been taking that project through the approval process. To the extent that eminent domain is used, it would be through the Empire State Development Corporation, not through the city or EDC. So the short answer is, I'm not sure. I think that Columbia owns a lot of the property up there already. I think that their stated intention is to reach agreements with as many of the landowners as possible. There also is a significant amount of city-owned and MTA-owned land that obviously won't need to be condemned. So I think the hope is that there won't be much, if any, eminent domain used up there. That being said, it is an extremely important project for the future of the city. Columbia is one of the most important institutions in the city. As we've been looking at trying to grow new industries in New York and diversify the city's economy, one thing that we've found in innovation center after innovation center is that these innovation centers are anchored by major universities. Stanford in Silicon Valley, MIT in Boston, the list goes on. We believe that expanding, allowing Columbia to expand and improve, especially its sciences, is of vital importance to the future of the city. So, you know, we're strongly supportive of the Manhattan Bill project. That being said, I think it's in everyone's interest not to go to eminent domain. You know, one of the things that I think people miss about eminent domain, people talk about it as if we want to condemn land and it's easy for us to do it. Eminent domain is a horrible pain in the neck, as it should be. It's extremely time-consuming. More importantly, it's unbelievably expensive. You could pay a premium that's probably 40 or 50% over market value, and it would still be cheaper than doing eminent domain, which is why in Willits Point, for example, where the fight was largely about eminent domain, we made as many deals as we've had. We don't want to have to condemn any of these landowners. It's from a philosophical perspective, it's always better to reach a deal with people, and just from a practical perspective, it's much better to avoid it. And I'm sure Columbia feels the same way up in Manhattanville.
Can you say a few words about the stimulus package and whether
that your influence is in terms of projects? It's a good question. You know what? I'm not sure what the answer to that question is. I think that, let me change that. There are most certainly benefits to historic preservation. Whether there are elements of the stimulus that are geared specifically to historic preservation, I'm not sure. To be honest with you, we're still parsing through the bill. It is a very complicated bill. I'm not sure the people who passed it know what's in it. We haven't figured out everything that's in it either. But just by way of example, a significant amount of the transportation funding the city is going to restoration of the Brooklyn Bridge. That's obviously a historic preservation project. We're hoping to take some of the money and put it into Bush Terminal, as I mentioned. That's a historic preservation project. But those, I don't think that's what you meant when you asked the question.
Say I had a $12 million preservation project. Is there a way that I can get that to your agency?
Yes.
Who would ask
the answer to your question is yes, but again, it's not, at least as far as I know, and I'm just going through in my head what I do know about the bill, as far as I know, it's not specifically because it's a preservation project. What we're looking for under the stimulus bill is construction projects, and whether those construction projects are historic preservation or new construction, we're sort of agnostic between. I think that depending on the preservation project, that might get some points in our minds. Depending on the new construction, that might get some points in our minds. On the financing side, there are a number of new tax-exempt financing mechanisms that have been created and existing mechanisms that have been expanded. We're hoping to launch in the next month or month and a half one of these new programs, which will be applicable to what are called recovery zones. And recovery zones will cover mostly poorer neighborhoods of the city, so I don't know where your project is, but that might be eligible. And what we're going to do is we're going to take applications, because we have about $400 million in taxes and bonds that we can issue on behalf of projects. So what I would recommend that we do is, let me give you my card, why don't you tell me a little bit more about your project, and then we can strategize more specifically. Yes? It is in Sunset Park, just I think it's down around here. On the waterfront. So around 95th Street or so, I think. Not far. About 59th Street. Yeah. Sure.
I'm just interested in EDC's policy about preservation, specifically historic district preservation, and the success of Tribeca, SoCo, all of these in the country. We're always having debates at the HDC about trying to make a case for is there a general philosophy about neighborhood preservation that EDC has, and how can we support our efforts to preserve neighborhoods? And then also I have a specific question about, I don't know if you saw Richard Lowe's op-ed here, about sustainability, and about the economic impact and impact on sustainability of preserving homes, retrofitting older homes,
Well, in terms of designation of historic districts, we generally don't get involved in that one way or another, and we haven't done a specific study of economic impact. I mean, there are clearly areas where historic designation has had a positive impact on neighborhoods, preserved their characters. Nobody wants to see another Penn Station. Nobody would want to see many neighborhoods of the city bulldozed and have their characters change dramatically. Again, it's like everything. It's a tough balancing act. You live in a city that is physically limited in size. And when you make a decision that a certain area can't be changed, it means that if you want the city to grow and develop, that it either is going to have to happen somewhere else, which is going to change some other neighborhood, or it's not going to happen in the city at all. I don't think we're at the point in New York where you would say that you can't designate and you shouldn't designate historic districts because too much of the city is a historic district, but it's always a consideration to figure out, well, if you preserve this area and this area and this area, where is the future going to be? Where is the development going to be? I don't have a simple answer to that, and that's why I'm glad that someone else has to deal with that. But in terms of your question about sustainability, sustainability is a very important part of the work that we at EDC do. It's a very important part of the administration's plans for the city. As you know, we issued a couple of years ago the Plan YC, Plan for Sustainable New York, to make sure that as we grew by what we think will be another million people over the next 21 years, that we in fact decrease our carbon footprint. And so the way that that manifests itself at EDC is, for example, at Willits Point, something I think I failed to mention, is that not only are we remediating the land and creating a new community, but it's going to be the first LEED-certified neighborhood in New York. And we hope that that will be a model for future development. At our own buildings, we're looking at ways that we can save energy and make those buildings more efficient. We're working on what I think will be a very innovative project in the Brooklyn Army Terminal, which, as you can imagine, a huge building built in 17 months in 1919. Energy efficiency wasn't one of the things that they were considering. We're working on retrofitting that building, which we think will save millions of dollars a year, and hopefully will crack the code on one of the great problems that retrofitting faces throughout the city and throughout the world, which is that landlords have to pay for energy efficiency, the tenants are the ones who largely benefit economically from them, and we think we have a model that may solve that problem that we hope can be replicated around the city. Also, the mayor's office of sustainability is looking at retrofitting buildings, residential and commercial, throughout the city through the building code, and I believe we'll have announcements on that in the coming months. So it's a very important part of what we're doing. An interesting story. I was talking to the person who was in charge of constructing a new headquarters for an investment bank a few years ago, and I was talking to him about energy efficiency, and he said that when they started to design the building, they put all the green bells and whistles into the building, mostly because they thought they'd get good PR for it. And he said, though, that when they actually started to go back and look at the economics, that every single one of those elements that they put in will pay for itself. And I think that the business community is learning that, and our hope is that, therefore, there will be a cooperative spirit between us and developers and builders going forward in cleaning the city. It's in all of our interests, because if we don't figure out a way to lower consumption per capita, we're not going to be able to grow.
You may be aware of that with the state of development that makes the red book has been a real contentious issue with the neighborhood. And less than a couple of years ago, we went out with an RFP that was largely based on community input. And as you described that, that was going to be more residential, commercial, and so forth. And now EDC, I think the authority has decided on a different use of the waterfront. And I'm listening to what you were saying in other projects talking about community input. And so when this changed, you went with Phoenix Beverages and the local community and commercial businesses, which are a block away, but yet miles away from really being able to access and benefit from the development of that. You know, at what point or in what ways can the community be a part of what that development is? I mean, I feel like we've really been shut out of it, and we were hoping more for an adaptive use reuse of it. And, you know, so Phoenix Beverages was selected, and then also Cultural Component was also sole-sourced. And, you know, we've not been able to participate in any sort of RFP that we feel like would benefit the community. And we've been trying to work with EDC, and we've really been kind of told more. And we've had a lot of discussions, but we've not been able to participate.
Well, it's a good question, and the truth is that there's probably no project that we have anywhere that satisfies everyone, which is not to say that you shouldn't try to satisfy people,
right.
But place, especially like Red Hook, is that they're different communities. And, you know, when you talk to the people in the Red Hook houses, for example, and ask them what they want to see, they want to see jobs. And, you know, the other proposals, there's a specific proposal that people have been pushing, certain people in the community have been pushing, one of the responses to RFP, would have created almost no jobs, generated almost no rent for the city. And in fact, among all of the respondents to the original RFP, was probably not one of the better respondents. It also relied on, you know, Marina with her luxury yachts, which I'm not sure would be economically viable today, and hotels in Red Hook, which I'm also not sure would be economically viable today. So, you know, whether the choice is between Phoenix and that other proposal, I think that's something of a false choice, but that being said, that doesn't mean that this is the only choice, the right next choice.
But, yeah, but what I'm, the point is, I mean, I'm not trying to argue which are the better choices, but I think there were a lot of instances when EDC kind of said one thing, and, you know, that we're even just saying, I think there were some things that they easily could have done to work with the community, and we asked, and they said they would, and they didn't. And I think also the selection of the cultural component would have been something that the community very much could have participated in. I think there were some really easy things that EDC could have done to work with us that would have helped us, because at least we're participating in this. We do have a voice. And I totally agree with you. There are so many diverse, and we welcome and recognize that within our own community.
Yeah.
But I think there were some real missed opportunities to really persuade the community that I think EDC missed.
Well, as I said, just because you can't please everyone doesn't mean that you shouldn't try, and if we haven't tried the way that we should, I think it'd be important for us to talk and to hear some of the things that we could have done that we didn't do, so that we can make sure we don't make a mistake going forward. So let's talk after this. Thank you.
Building on what you brought up, the sort of problem with what DC has done along with the waterfront in Red Hook has created a very, very negative sort of impression of EDC and of the other communities of which I remember surrounding that area, has a very, very high level of frustration and a distinct sense that, you know, Robert Moses still works.
I can assure you, based on the difficulty that we have getting any of our projects done, that Robert Moses is not alive. That being said, you know, I can understand the frustration, especially in Red Hook. You know, the way that this has played out over the last 7 years has not, by any stretch of the imagination, been ideal. You know, the city had a proposal, made a number of assumptions about other people's land, which turned out not to be correct. As a result of that, the plans that we had for the land that we did control no longer made sense, we didn't think, and so it had to be rethought. If there are things that we can do to re-engage with the community and sort of improve that interaction, it's something I'm more than happy to participate in, and I'd, again, be very interested in speaking with you and hearing some of your thoughts, because we don't operate the way Robert Moses did. I can assure you of that much. And throughout the city, we do see community impact, and it's always, I mean, even from a purely selfish point of view, it's always easier for us to do what we want to do if the community is with us rather than against us. So if there are things that we can do to help improve that relationship, I'm more than happy to try to pursue this.
I'm wondering what EDC is doing to support and make more sustainable for you, which makes such a tremendous economic contribution.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're working on a number of projects with arts organizations in the city. We have a number of projects, for example, in the Banff Cultural District, some of which are actually moving forward. We'll have announcements on relatively soon. There are cultural and community elements in a lot of the other projects that we do. I am a firm believer that, like universities, one of the great resources that New York has is its artistic community. And that the diversity of the talent and creativity in New York York is one of the things that makes it an economic magnet to people, both in terms of supplying employees to companies who think differently and in ways that I think are unique, but also because the culture of New York is one of the great attractors to people to come and live in the city. One of the things that I think will help the situation that EDC has nothing to do with and is a fortunate byproduct of an unfortunate situation is that with the decline in the economy, I think costs generally across the city will come down, which means that artists will be able to afford to live in the city, hopefully to a greater extent than they have in a long time. That arts institutions won't be forced out of space that they have by real estate pressure. That's not a long-term solution. That's a short-term solution.
We've seen that change.
Yes, exactly. Where we have at EDC a group called the Business Development Group, and the Business Development Group is divided into desks, each of which has a responsibility for a different sector. One of our desks is the not-for-profit desk, and the not-for-profit desk is undertaking right now a study on how to invigorate the arts community in the city. I'm not going to pretend for you that we have an answer yet, and I'm not going to pretend that when we do have an answer that it's going to solve all the problems that the arts in the city face. But we do hope that in the coming months we'll be able to announce something which is actionable and which will at least be a material improvement on the condition now. And so, stay tuned, I guess, is what I would say. And if in a few months you still haven't heard from us, you should come back to me and ask me why.
Do you have any involvement in the personal recreation uses of the workstations?
Well, we have a number of projects along the waterfront that include uses such as that. We're working on a new East River Esplanade, which will run from the Battery Maritime Building up to the Lower East Side. And there will be opportunities from that Esplanade to interact with the water. We're working on the Greenway in the South Bronx that will have similar elements. The park that we're working on in Sunset Park at Bush Terminal will also have similar elements. That being said, I think that that's in the waterways of New York, with the uses that are there, with the currents, that you have to be careful with those kinds of uses. We've seen probably in the last year or two of people who are using recreational boats like kayaks and get caught in the currents and find themselves stranded in the middle of the harbor. So we're trying to figure out safe ways to give people access to the waterfront. We think that it's a great opportunity for the city. It's one of the great underused resources, but we want to make sure that we're not putting people's lives in danger.
There was some talk about putting in a pier on Roosevelt Island.
No, that's the state controls what's going on, so I'm not sure about that. Okay.
You spoke about the shoe box.
Yep.
Those that you didn't mention about the Willoughby Square Park, downtown within the area. So, would you be at the meeting here today at 2 o'clock?
I'm not going to be there personally, but if it's about Willoughby Square, then my assumption is that the team that's working on that from EDC will be there. We now control that property. The city has acquired the last parcel of that property. We're seeking to build an underground parking garage, which is greatly needed in the area, and a landscape park on top. There will also be elements in the area around it that will pay tribute to the abolitionist history of Brooklyn, which are part of that project too. But if there are specific issues that you have, I'm happy to talk to you about them now, or I can give you my card and you can send me an email. But I'm happy to help. Okay. probably one more question.
I think the desire of these projects, reports about how financing for them is in trouble and things have to change. So how many
There is no project in this environment that's entirely immune to being funded. Even projects that are fully funded by the city face challenges. The city faces its own fiscal issues. That being said, I think we've been enormously successful so far at keeping our projects moving forward. We had to, at times, change them in ways to make them more economically feasible. We've had to phase projects, which originally we had hoped would happen all at once, so that they could be swallowed in smaller pieces, make them more financially digestible. We've stretched out time frames on some projects to deal with economic downturn. But off the top of my head, and I've been asked this question a couple of times, I can think of maybe one project, and I'm sure there are probably one or two others, one project off the top of my head where we've literally said, all right, this isn't going to happen, let's put it on hold. And we're moving forward on everything else that we're looking on, and I think you're going to see substantial progress on all the projects that I mentioned. Are they going to happen exactly the way they had been planned for when they were first announced? Are they going to happen exactly on those time frames? Probably not. In some cases, yes, but in a lot of cases, no. But we are committed to moving these projects forward. We think that it's extremely important, especially in an economic downturn, that the city keep investing in itself. It's a mistake that we've made in the past where during downturns we've stopped making capital investments. And the consequences of that were felt for decades after that decision. And that is the classic example of Pennywise and Pound of Worth. We can't do that again.
Mr. Bespeakler is doing some presentation and come to your coffee. And he's back to create another box of bats in your coffee. So, thank you all.
Yeah. I wish I could have been used to be a small quantity.